I am often disappointed when I go back for seconds or a second sip or, you know, the same bottle of wine or the same restaurant, and I have a different experience than last time. And I find myself feeling disappointed, not because the experience itself is bad, but because it's different from what I had before. And I think when we're actually talking about taste, all we're actually talking about is trusting our particular experience of a thing. And I think that if we were honest, you know, we'd be willing to say, I love this beer, you know? And then the next time you go, wow, I really don't like this beer. And the other person might be dismayed. They might go, it's the same beer. And it's like, but no, it's not. Like, the first sip of a martini is always the best sip. Welcome to Hey Creator. I'm Jeff Goines, and this is the mixtape for the creative class, where we discover together what it is we're doing with our art and with our lives. And today we're going to talk about taste. What is taste? Taste is discernment. It is the willingness to disagree with what virtually everyone else is saying when you have a different experience. I want to argue that developing your taste is one of the first necessary steps to becoming a real artist, a real and honest creator. Because how can you contribute something interesting to the world if you're just doing what everybody else has done before? The only way for us to find our own style, our own way of doing things and talking about things and communicating about ideas is to disagree. It is to go against the grain at some point and go, I don't like this music. I didn't like this restaurant. I didn't think that was a good bottle of wine. I think Topo Chico is overrated. Just kidding. I don't think that. I love Topo Chico. Please remain our sponsors. So that's what we're going to be talking about today, is what do you do with all those times when you disagree with what everyone else seems to be saying? And how do you begin to trust your own experience while doubting your own story of a previous experience? We always want to be alive and awake and aware of what's happening in front of us so that we can do our best to capture it and share it with the world in a way where they'll have their own unique experience. And this is the art of living and living as an artist. Let's get into it. This is part one of our two-part chat about why taste is important for artists. Stay tuned for the second part next week.
Got me now?
Yeah.
Perfect. The audio travails never kind of really, they never end, do they? It's like 28 shows later. We still struggle to hear each other.
Yeah, it's a metaphor.
Wait, are you enjoying a beverage over there?
Iced coffee.
No, oh, I thought it was going to be death in the afternoon.
I thought about doing it. Do you have the stuff?
Hold that thought.
What is that? Is that absinthe?
I don't have any bubbly.
Oh.
I have a French absinthe that I found in Charleston at my friend's liquor store called NV Absinthe Vert.
Green absinthe, yeah.
Yeah, but it's the real deal.
Is it good?
I think so. I have had some varied and varying experiences, but haven't really had that much of it. Just a sip here and there, and it's I don't know. It's very possible that it's has some mild hallucinogenic piece to it, but I can't really tell.
That's not the case with absinthe anymore. That's an old thing, but I don't know. Maybe you got a special bottle.
It says it has wormwood. Grand wormwood. Artemisia absinthium.
Uh-huh. I don't think absinthe can have hallucinogenic effects anymore. Does absinthe...
Well, I think that the laws had changed so that we could finally...
import it?
Import the real stuff, and that was you know, maybe a decade or so ago or even longer, but yeah, I think you can get the real stuff now.
My understanding that may be true. My understanding is that at best people tripping out on absinthe was exaggeration. At worst, they were making it up. You know, it wasn't like they were drunk.
Yeah.
Nothing, here I'm reading something that says, nothing in absinthe will make you hallucinate, never has, never will. There's a chemical found in wormwood, absinthe's primary flavoring, called thujone, that's known to be a convulsant at extremely high doses. But in order to get to that point, you'd have to drink so much alcohol that you'd be dead drunk before you felt any effects.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. So I'm not going to pull a Picasso here. Sipping on this stuff. Freak out, cut my ear off.
Van Gogh, yeah.
Or sorry, Van Gogh.
Yeah, he was crazy to begin with. It had nothing to do with the absinthe. The traditional method of drinking absinthe is with cold water and sugar.
Yeah. You got to make the louche, which is that white, milky characteristic you get when you add water.
Yeah, it's interesting that they add more sugar to it because it's pretty sweet and it's made from sugar, you know? I typically either drink it on ice because it does that, it gets really... the flavor crystals as they get colder become more pronounced, which is kind of fun, or as a death in the afternoon cocktail.
Do you really?
Yeah, it's quite good. Chantel introduced that drink to me.
Interesting. I've never actually tried it, and I think there are some famous cocktails with absinthe.
Sazerac has an absinthe
Sazzy
rinse, which is,
there you go,
quite good.
Yeah, that's a good drink.
I made a cocktail once with that was Sazerac-y with chartreuse in it. It was
really good. I'm a fan of chartreuse. Had some interesting experiences with friends getting a little too wild, a little too wacky. Where are you recording today?
This is our playroom.
Oh, it's got carpets.
Yeah, I figured it'd be a little less echoey than downstairs, and I moved the computer, I moved the desktop up here because we've got a desk up here, and it's the closest thing to resembling an office right now.
Definitely less echo. How was New York?
It was good. I spent the most money on a hotel room that I've ever spent there, which is, you know, apropos.
I hope it was worth it.
It was, and that's the thing. It's like either spend a decent amount of money on a hotel room in Manhattan and be disappointed, or spend an exorbitant amount and be quite satisfied. And I was quite satisfied.
Now, was it like an actual hotel with like a front desk and, you know, like full like room service, or was it more like Airbnb?
No, it was a boutique hotel. I found the Airbnb pickings to be pretty slim downtown where we were looking to stay. I know it's a hip thing to do the Airbnb thing. You know, all the kids in your generation are doing it, but we're kind of hotel people. I like, if I can find a good Airbnb, cool. But I've been disappointed by so many experiences. I've been blown away by a handful, but I've been disappointed by a lot of them.
Yeah.
Because I guess hospitality is really important to me, which is, you know, it's such a bougie thing to say, but it's true, you know, and... Well, once you've experienced a certain level of service, it's hard to go back from that, right? And once you've stayed in like a decent hotel, which for me is typically not a luxury brand, although it can be, but it's usually something boutique, fun, quirky, small, unique.
Sure.
Like I've been to the Four Seasons and Ritz-Carlton, and I like Lowe's hotels. Those are nice five-star. Mm-hmm. But those are all kind of like anesthetized, you know? They're very... sterile kind of experiences.
Sure.
And I like something kind of quirky and fun. So we stayed in a boutique hotel right off of Times Square, actually.
Cool.
Which was really cool. Quite small. And like you stepped into it from, you know, the outside world, which is hustle and bustle, Times Square, busyness, you know, theater district. And then you step inside and it's like a completely different experience. Feels like you step back in time. You're back in the 1930s. Mm. They've got Frank Sinatra playing. They've got bellhops with the little hats, little pillbox hats, whatever they're called.
Monkey hats.
What are they called?
I just called it a monkey hat. I don't know why, because wasn't there like an organ grinder that would have like a monkey with one of those little hats on?
Totally. Like in every
movie from the, you know.
Yeah, like every cartoon ever, right?
Yeah.
What are these called? It's called a bellhop hat. What is it called? Is it a pillbox? Bellboy hat or bellboy cap. So what's a pillbox hat?
I think that's a lady's hat.
Oh, it's the same hat, but it's for women.
Ah.
or so it appears.
Well, I think men and women should be able to wear it.
I know. I appreciate you getting that talking point in there. I don't think any women wore those hats in the hotel. I think it was only men that I saw.
Yeah, it's nice.
And we saw Hamilton, and I had a couple of early morning walks in Central Park. That was nice. It was hot. And I had one of the best martinis I've ever had.
Well, I like the sound of that.
And it was at the hotel bar where I was meeting somebody in the publishing world. I felt very literary having a publishing meeting in downtown Manhattan over a couple of after work drinks. Now I had a dirty gin martini.
Ooh.
That kind of blew my mind.
Hmm.
And then I went back the next night and tried to like reproduce it, and it just didn't happen.
Hmm. Same bartender or
different bartender? Same bar, different tender.
Different tender. That can happen.
They had like a house martini. So the next night I was like, oh, maybe that's what I had, you know? And so I ordered the house martini off the menu where they like make their own vermouth.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a bit different. And I think I tried to just order the same drink again, or maybe I got off of that after that, but I couldn't find my way back to that experience that I'd had, which was like the first sip of this martini. And I was just like, oh, like I felt like everything worked well together. The gin and the brine and the olives blew me away. Like everything was like dialed in.
Blue cheese olives?
They didn't have blue cheese olives, which is my preference. But they had these incredible olives that I'd never had before. These like big green olives that were just almost citrusy. They were like full of flavor. Anyway, it was like a $25 martini. So I had two of them.
The Casta Vulturano olive, maybe?
I've had a lot of olives in my day. And yeah.
That's my favorite olive, the Casta Vulturano.
I've had that before. And I don't know if this was it or not. Maybe it was. Or maybe there was something unique to the brine, but it was full of flavor.
I can honestly say that I may have had one of the best martinis I've ever had this last week as well.
In Charleston?
In Charleston.
Where was it? They have an incredible food scene.
Oh my goodness. It was at a kind of an upscale steakhouse called Halls. And, you know, it's just kind of like one of those spots. You do kind of feel like you're walking. When you walk through the door, you feel like you're kind of going back in time. You know, yeah. Like you're greeted by like half a dozen people who are all like smiling and want to make you feel pampered. And the bar was just buzzing with, you know, couples and hipsters and you know, old school, obviously practiced drinkers, and it was just a cool scene. It was just like boom, you're like, oh shit, this is a Wednesday night in South Carolina in downtown, you know, in Charleston. And it was just like, whoa, this place is fucking hopping. So yeah, we ordered some drinks before the meal. I was just hanging out with friends, and my wife ordered a dirty Chopin martini with blue cheese olives, and it was like the size of a hot tub. Like the thing was so big.
What's a Chopin?
Chopin is just like a bougie vodka. I don't know, it's somewhere between like Grey Goose and Kettle One or something, you know. But it was incredible.
A dirty martini with the right brine and the right olive with vodka is a great combo, because vodka is so neutral as a spirit that it can really kind of bring that to life. A dirty gin martini is like playing with fire.
Because of the botanicals.
Oh, yeah, man. But when it's right, it's right.
Yeah.
I've gone down the rabbit hole of bougie vodkas, and I think it's all bullshit.
Yeah. Agreed.
I mean, there was a piece a while back where it talked about how high-end vodka was basically a marketing campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Like, every spirit eventually becomes vodka, you know? Like, when you don't infuse it with anything and you just distill it to the point that it's a clear spirit, you've got vodka.
Yeah. Flavorless.
And, yeah.
Odorless.
Yeah.
Made famous in Prohibition.
Right. So There's no real art to that. And I've had them. I've had the bougie vodkas, you know, like the Grey Gooses and what are all the, I've tried most of them. I was at a Russian restaurant in Portland years ago, and my friend and I ordered a flight of vodka shots.
Yeah.
And we're like sipping them and smelling them and talking about them because we're like whiskey guys and we're trying to be bougie hipsters. And I said, how are you supposed to drink this stuff? You know, like, I don't really, I'm like smelling it, trying to get an odor, you know, yeah, whatever. And we're just, you know, we've got six shots in front of us or something like that. And the bartender goes, he just kind of like smirks and he says, I think you're just supposed to shoot it. And we said, all right, fair enough. And we just started, you know, shooting these shots of vodka and went on with our evening. But I think that's like indicative of a whole part of middle America, which is now a thing that affects, you know, large swaths of the world, which is, you know, making an experience more than it actually is, like sniffing some high-end flights of vodka when you're just supposed to be shooting it.
It's like spending money on spirits just for the sake of saying you can.
Hey, creator. This episode is brought to you by Aura. Aura is a digital safety service that monitors and protects your identity, finances, devices, and more from the bad guys. We all love the internet, right? We love it so much that we knowingly take risks every day while doing little to protect ourselves online. We do this because most security tools are complicated, expensive, or just plain confusing. So now, for a limited time, Aura is offering our listeners a 14-day trial plus a check on your data to see if you have already been part of a data breach, all for free when you visit goinswriter.com/Aura. That's goinswriter.com/AURA. Go there and sign up for a 14-day free trial to see if you've already been part of a data breach. It's totally free. That's goinswriter.com/Aura. Certain terms apply. See site for details. Aura is the new standard in digital safety. Okay. Let's get back to the show.
We always joke about Johnny Walker, like Blue Label.
Uh-huh.
And it's just, I mean, it's just not, it's not that great, but it's so fucking expensive. It's like these guys, these business guys, you know, when they're having an upscale, fancy, you know, guys on the town, everybody's, you know, still in their work clothes or whatever, ordering this stuff. It's just ridiculous. It's like $95 a shot or something like that.
Oh,
it's
just really?
It's just to say that you can, because it's not that great. It's really, I'm sorry. I am sorry. I know they're a sponsor. I just don't think it's
I
that
great. I know they're a sponsor. What is it? Blended scotch? Is that what Johnny Walker Blue is? I've had Johnny Walker Red, which is just standard or whatever, and it's fine. Yeah.
But really, a lot of it comes down to loyalty. And then the other piece is like, as you said, the marketing piece. And then can you get share of mind with like these, you know, people that have a lot of money? And it's like, well, yeah, there you go. They got share of top of mind or whatever for fancy business dinners. It was kind of a cliche, to be honest with you. Sorry, Johnny Walker lovers.
It is interesting to develop your own sense of discerning taste, right? Like I'm starting to experience that with wine, where I buy this, you know, decent bottle of wine, $50 to $100 bottle of wine. And I, you know, find a Napa cab that everybody's talking about. And I try it and I go, it was all right, you know? And then I find, you know, some $18 Malbec or whatever, you know, and Zinfandel. I've had some like sub $20 bottles of Zinfandel that I really liked. And I find something that just kind of blows me away. And it's not always the cheaper thing, you know. I've had really good bottles of wine at restaurants, but I think it's an interesting thing to try a thing that everybody else says is great, and then just and kind of sit in the experience, whatever it is—a glass of whiskey, bottle of wine, a meal, whatever—and then to go, am I missing something here? Right? Is there something about this experience that everybody else is raving about that I'm missing? And just to pay attention and, you know, learn and ask questions, because certainly there are nuanced experiences. There are things that I enjoy now that I didn't enjoy, you know, when I was younger. But if the answer is no, there's nothing that, as far as I can tell, that I'm missing from this experience. And right now, I'm not enjoying it that much. And I think there's a freedom in being able to go, no, I don't like this, and I trust myself enough to, you know, believe my own opinion on this. And the development of your own unique taste, I think, is a necessary step in the evolution of a human being. And it is a good step for humans. It's a necessary step for an artist. You've got to know what good is to you and then be able to trust it. And you have to have both of those things. You have to have a definition of good, and you've got to, like, be willing to bet on it. And most people don't do that, I think. Most people are not willing to go against the masses, whatever the masses look like in your own respective part of the world or industry or whatever, but to basically stand up and go, this is stupid. I don't get it. And I'm going to go the other way is obviously very risky. You're going against hundreds of thousands of years of human evolution and social evolution, you know, how people have sort of survived by fitting in with each other. And you have to do that. Like you have to go the other way and go, it was all right. Or I didn't like it. Everybody loved that movie and I thought it was trash. Right. Or the opposite. Everybody thinks this movie sucks and I thought it was incredible.
Can you name a recent example? I've got a couple of funny examples, but I know that you've seen a TV show that, like, the world is raving about and watched a couple of episodes and gone, it was boring. Or I don't get it.
Well, another example of that would be I recently started rewatching The Dark Knight Rises. Because I remember just like that, like I saw that movie and I just kept thinking about it afterwards. And I remember seeing it in the theater with my brother-in-law at the time. And he was like, that was so stupid. And I loved it. And I was like, oh, that's weird. So, and everybody hated Bane's voice in that movie because it was like,
really?
You know,
it's so good.
And I liked it. I thought he made a choice and I respect the choice he made. And I remember how much Christopher Nolan kills opening scenes, especially in Dark Knight and The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah.
And I like how in that opening scene, everybody thinks they're doing it their way, but really they're doing it Bane's way. And that's, you know, that's kind of the motif of the movie, is just when you think this is happening, this other thing is actually happening. Anyway, I watched the opening scene for about 5 or 10 minutes and I was like, oh, this is not good acting. They're not, I don't believe them. I don't believe that choice. I don't believe that choice. And I don't believe that choice. You're performing lines to each other. You're reciting lines to each other, which is not the same thing as acting. And I turned it off, you know? And I'm sure there'll be a point in my life where I'll turn it back on. I'll just be interested in kind of special effects, you know, blow me away kind of thing. But I wasn't interested in watching that at that time. And I allowed myself to turn it off when in previous seasons of life, if everybody's raving about this thing, if everybody's talking about it, I'll just kind of go, well, everybody thinks this is great. But I've realized that most things that everybody thinks are great, most of those things are just things that somebody at some point said, hey, this is really good, and other people agreed with them. And in some cases, you've got one, whatever it is, food critic or influencer that people are just parroting. I like watching a movie come out and reading the initial reviews on Rotten Tomatoes and then kind of seeing where it ends up. Because sometimes it kind of, you know, goes like this and then kind of comes back. And other times, you know, the initial vibe is what is with it the whole way. But I was watching, I was looking at going to see a movie recently, and it started out where, like, the initial critiques of it weren't that good. And I was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't see this, because it was at like 60%, and now it's at like 89%. I'm like, oh, maybe I was
rebounded.
The other scenario that I think of was we were in Chicago, and I wanted to get a pizza, but it was late. There was no place that was open, and I tried to get reservations at this restaurant in Chicago called Au Cheval, which has been voted to have the best burger in the country. And I couldn't get in there. And so we had a late dinner at a Nobu restaurant, you know, sushi restaurant and hotel in Chicago. And I remember a friend of mine talking about celebrating, making a bunch of money. And he took his whole family out to Nobu. And this was out in LA, which is where it started. Anyway, I love sushi. I was like, okay, whatever, you know. So we went to this, like there was like a rooftop dining area at Nobu. And music was loud. It was like a dance club in there. You know, we who were approaching 40 at the time were sort of out of place. And, you know, there was just a bunch of like frou-frou cocktails that were expensive and sushi that was pretty good, you know. And then this just like super clubby kind of vibe. And I was like, it was like a $300 dinner, you know. And I was like, this is fine. You know, I was disappointed. I wish I would have just ordered a pizza and stayed at the hotel. And I was like, I don't get what the big deal is here, you know? And I don't know what other people's experiences are, but I wonder if other people's experiences are that they have those questions too. Sometimes they go, why is everybody talking about this? I don't think this is that big of a deal. Or why does everybody hate this? I thought this was all right. And the voices of opinion are so loud that to object to them, you know, in a very real way would be sort of committing a form of social suicide. And maybe that's extreme. I don't know. Obviously, there are people disagreeing all the time. But I have found in my own life that it's taken quite a bit of courage to stand up and say, I don't like this thing. And the more I do that, the more I find people who agree with me, you know, go, yeah, I agree. And they may be just, you know, parroting or whatever, how would you know? But it is interesting that once you go against the tide a little bit, you find other people who go, yeah, you know, me too. And regardless of whether or not it's right or wrong whether or not those people in particular are agreeing because they actually agree or because they're just, you know, they're now following a new leader. I think all of us at some point have to figure out what our taste is and trust it. And, you know, I have friends where somebody will recommend a bottle of wine or something and we'll try it. We'll be honest with each other. And I used to find it very sort of threatening when somebody disagreed, you know, I didn't really like that very much. I'm like, you're wrong, you know, but I'm like, oh, that was their experience and that's valid. That makes sense. And I have a lot more patience and understanding with it because I do it too, right? Like I'll get a bottle of wine or whatever, you know, get a martini at a cocktail and then try to revisit that experience the next day or a week or a month or a year later and have a completely different experience. Because you can never actually capture an experience. And in fact, there's an app called like, what is it? Wine Now, I think is what it's called. My friend Charlie introduced me to it. And it tells you the best times of the month to drink wine with respect to this, wherever the moon is in its monthly cycle, because that affects how wine tastes and what kind of wine you should drink at what time of month. Because depending on what time of month and even what time of day you drink a glass of wine, it'll taste different. And so it's an interesting thing, I think, to even be able to say, oh, I liked that thing. And it's like, no, you liked the combination of things that had to happen that culminated in the event that you are now calling that experience. But that thing, that restaurant, that movie, that meal, in particular, you didn't necessarily like. You enjoyed that whole experience. And if you went back and had another experience, it might be completely different. Like me loving The Dark Knight when I first saw it and then watching it, you know, years later and going, yeah, okay.
No. Well, it is campy. I mean, I'm sorry to go back to The Dark Knight.
Yeah, sure.
It's a very campy conceit and setup. Of course, it's very Nolan-esque and it's kind of over the top, you know, stunts and whatnot and practical stunts at that, which is pretty impressive given that they basically fake somebody's death and tow an airplane to its demise, which was very strange. But it's very campy. As you said it, it's very comic booky, But I think that was part of his oeuvre.
Yeah, I mean, it for sure. That's an interesting trilogy because Batman Begins is sort of like an anti-superhero movie. It's not a superhero movie. You know, it's a very, which is apropos of Batman, right? It's especially dark and moody. You know, Dark Knight is nothing like a superhero movie. It's basically a serial killer horror movie, right? Like that's what it is. And then The Dark Knight Rises is a completely different genre of film. Like they all kind of stand alone as unique experiences. Batman Begins is kind of this like revenge action story. Dark Knight is basically like
with ninjas.
Yeah, horror. Yeah, right. It's like a horror movie, a ninja movie, serial killer movie, and then just like a good old comic book adventure movie.
Sure, but you realize that the beginning of The Dark Knight Rises is like incredibly depressing. It's like Batman's not can't walk,
right.
You know, he's lost his true love. Yep. He basically is a recluse. Like he's withered to nothing. He can barely literally like get off the couch, and it's very depressing. Like it's a very it's not an uplifting movie in the least, you know, maybe until the ending, but it's pretty like heavy.
Well, yeah, I do remember that, like, yeah, and it has a noir aspect to it because it just keeps going downhill, right? Like, oh, he's found love, things are looking up, and oh, nope, this is not working out well either, you know?
Oh, yeah, and now he's broken his back and he's been left for dead in a prison somewhere in hell.
Right, yeah, completely abandoned by everybody, whoever would have thought of loving him, you know? Anyway, you had some examples of shows or something that everybody thinks are great and you thought were trash.
Oh, no. I can think of the more recent example would just be like Squid Game. Sorry. Is that what it's called? Squid Game?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Squid Games. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And that's like a Korean TV program that everybody loves.
Yeah. I saw part of it.
It was nominated for some Emmys and so on and so forth. And I just could not get into it. I was like, this is campy bullshit. Like, I just don't like it. I'm sorry. And I just couldn't hang with it. It was like, all right, I'm reading the subtitles. I get the gist of it. I just don't care.
Right.
Sorry. Sorry, world.
Yeah.
But that was a very much a pandemic, like also phenomenon because everybody's pent up and they've got all this pent up aggression. Here's this show about, you know, this evil game master played by adults where, you know, adults are dying who don't win the game or something.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, they get
pretty grotesque.
Yeah, they get killed, murdered.
I get that it's an allegory about corporate greed, okay, but
okay. I imagine, you know, there's cultural elements there too, but that's a good example of like, you know, it's a Korean show. And so the PC thing to do is sort of go, oh, I liked that a lot. Even the parts that made no sense to me at all.
Right? Culturally.
Right. It's like a very Portlandia kind of thing to do. I imagine, you know, it's like, oh, that was so good. I understood none of it. You know, it's like really, wow.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
Going back to Nobu, honestly, I didn't put two and two together, but Nobu Matsuhisa initially had a flagship restaurant in Beverly Hills. I don't know if it was Matsuhisa. This was before he teamed up with De Niro on the Nobu chain,
yeah,
right?
That's how De Niro found him, was at that restaurant.
So he does like a really interesting fusion, right? It's like Japanese and Peruvian. I didn't know that either, but I have been to Matsuhisa in Aspen, Colorado with my daughter when she was really young. And it was like one of the best experiences. It's like a converted kind of like old late 1800s Victorian mansion that's been converted into this like really homey, warm restaurant in downtown Aspen. So it's like I think the house is a historic landmark.
Cool.
And, God, it was just one of the best experiences with a little kid too. It was like, I think we had quail eggs even. Uh-huh. And it was like, what are we doing? This is totally amazing.
Wow.
But I didn't actually put it together that he is the Nobu. Of course he's the
Nobu
Matsuhisa. I'm bringing it all full circle.
All that to say, you know, every experience is its own. I think taste is the ability to trust your own experience of a thing, to trust your own unique individual experience of an event is independent of what somebody else might experience. You could say this is the worst podcast ever. Like, this is the best podcast ever. And both of those things could be true, you know?
They often are.
Yeah. Worst for me, best for you. I don't know. I think of that line in that Jim Carrey movie, Liar Liar, where he sleeps with the boss or whatever to get ahead. And then his kid wishes that he would stop lying. And the next day wakes up and he can't tell it a lie. And she goes, you know, how was it for you? And he goes, I've had better. And then she kicks him out, you know, and all morning long, he's like brushing his teeth. He goes, I've had better. You know, and he's just like, why did I say that? But that line belies our tendency to lie, to not tell the truth for the sake of other people's comfort so that we can fit in. And the problem is when you find yourself lying about things that other people are lying about, and nobody's telling the truth, and this thing might actually suck, you know, like the sushi might be bad, but because nobody is willing to go another direction, nothing ever changes. I was reading a book about physics, and they were talking about all of these theories that Albert Einstein had, that they were certain he was wrong about, like the curvature of light and all these things that he had just kind of figured out in his head. Like he had literally figured them out working in the patent office through thought experiments before he ever did the math to prove that they were right. And he was like, I bet that's how that works, you know? And then he'd figure it out. But they were still theories. And then years later, they were able to, you know, actually prove some of these things, including the curvature of light thing. But he had all these ideas that his peers thought he was wrong about. In fact, he was admitted as a professor to some university in spite of the fact that he had some wild notions about the universe. And like all those ideas we now have been able to, or most of them, we've been able to test and prove, like experiment on, and these are not theories anymore, they're true, right?
Yeah.
Whereas at the time, everybody thought he was crazy.
He kind of looked crazy too.
Well, yeah, and he acted crazy. And he wasn't that good at math, you know? I mean, he was probably way better than we are, but amongst his peers, he did not stand out as an excellent mathematician, and he knew it. And so you've got this quirky guy who came up with some pretty wild stuff that he believed when everybody else was certain he was wrong. And he was right. And I think it takes a tremendous amount of courage and trust in yourself to stick to your guns. And I don't think it's like believe in yourself no matter what. That's not the lesson, because if you believe in yourself no matter what, I mean, you could very well be a psychopath, right? So there's a certain amount of self-awareness that we want to have, and it's good to be willing to admit when you might be wrong. But if you've seen like everything play out in front of you, and you've done the math, you've looked at the calculations, you've seen everything that you can see, you've drunk the bottle of wine, you've eaten the sushi, you've had the experience, and now you are able to interpret the experience, you have a choice, and the choice is binary, which is I'm going to trust my interpretation of the experience or not, right? And it seems to me that truthfully and honestly making your way through the world as an artist is to trust the interpretations of those experiences at the time that you have them and say, this is what I think this means right now. And I don't know, there's that scene in The Big Short where Christopher Nolan, who's this like nearly autistic prodigy, who is the first one to want to short the housing market, and everybody thinks he's wrong, you know, because the market does the opposite of what he thinks it's going to do, and it costs everybody, all of his investors, lots of money in the meantime because they've got to keep putting up more collateral until everything eventually kind of goes the other way, and he makes a bunch of money, hundreds of millions of dollars. But at one point, somebody asks him, like, couldn't you be wrong about this? And he goes, no. And then he kind of stops himself. He goes, well, maybe. He goes, and he just kind of shakes his head, bewildered, like, but I can't see how. Like, I cannot see how I could be wrong. And of course, you know, part of the mystery and wonder of life is to have these epiphanies where every once in a while you wake up and you look at your life and you look at yourself and you go, oh my God, I had no idea. You know, I had no idea I was treating this person this way. I had no idea that my drinking was affecting people this way. I had no idea that I was slowly killing myself with whatever, you know, and smoking, eating, bad habit, whatever it is. You know, like we do have these moments of awareness where we go, wow, I see things so clearly now that I couldn't have seen before. And I think those moments are wonderful. And in between those moments of epiphany, you know, how is one supposed to live? Are they supposed to live in such a way where they're doubting every experience they have? Well, that's, you know, even if life is a dream, that's not a particularly fun way to live where you're going, this isn't real, this isn't real, this isn't real. Part of the beauty of a dream is that it feels real while you're experiencing it and you get to fully immerse yourself into that experience. And so we all get to have all these little dreams throughout our life, or many dreams throughout our life, you know, these different experiences that tell these different stories. And a dream, you know, is just a version of life, right? What is life? Life is phenomena. It is things happening. And you have a particular perspective of those things happening, which is your perspective. And you piece all of these moments together in what we would call a story. And you give it meaning and you go, this is the story of my life, right? And a dream is that way. It's a flat but flash of random images that your mind makes sense out of, which is why dreams are so weird, you know, because they don't make sense, but your brain is really struggling to make a story out of these random flashes of ideas and sounds and things that you've got. I think it's funny, you know, to think about life as a dream, because you'll have these moments in a dream that when you remember them later, you go, wait, that's kind of weird that happened in the dream, right? But at the time, it didn't feel weird that like your grandfather sort of like suddenly appeared in a room. You know, it's like, then my grandfather was there and we weren't at the house anymore. We were, at this lake that we used to go, you know, to summer camp at, you know, it's like all these things. And I think of that, what is it, that part in Inside Out where they're trying to wake up the girl by giving her a scary dream. And she's sleeping and they're trying to sort of like break onto the movie set of the dream. But because it's a dream, there's this layer over it where no matter what happens, it's a part of the story that's trying to be played out. And it's sort of like a green screen, right? And so when the clown shows up, you know, he's sort of, you know, part of the play that's happening. Everything's trying to fit within the context of the play of the dream, even when random things appear, is the point. And our life is that way, right? Like, so you might have a dream and you go, I don't know why that happened. Like, that's weird. I guess that doesn't really fit, but at the time it felt totally normal. But have you ever had that happen in your life, right? Where you're retelling something or you're seeing something that you've never seen before and you go, was that always here? That wasn't always here. I remember telling a story to a friend of mine about something that happened years ago, and I was telling a story about my dad moving from Illinois to Alabama and opening a restaurant, and he started with this little hole in the wall place that was abandoned, and my friend who works construction in Chicago, he said it was like, and I'm just telling a story, you know, and he goes, it was abandoned. And I said, what? I don't know. It was abandoned. He goes, really? You know? And did he have to do this with the city and do that and blah, 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 blah. And I was like, I said, you know, nobody's ever asked me this. And I've told this story a bunch of times. And if I'm being honest, I don't remember. I don't know. I don't know if it was abandoned or not. It's likely that it was not, that I came up with that detail at some point. It was maybe close to true and I just kind of filled it in, and it may not be true. I don't know. And the problem is I could go and ask my dad, and if I go and ask him, hey dad, was that building abandoned? He would have one kind of answer, I imagine. But if I said, hey, remember that, you know, da, 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 and like that was abandoned, right? He would go, yeah, totally. Because you know, my dad's that kind of guy. And he wouldn't be lying. He would just be like, yeah, that sounds about right.
Sure.
And the reality is neither of us knows because we're not there anymore. You know, and he might have one memory and I might have another. And obviously I would trust his experience more than my own because he was doing it. I was just kind of on the outside looking in, and I went and visited him. But all that to say, there are these things that are constantly happening in your life that are quite random, right? And if you ever just kind of like stop and look around once in a while, you realize how weird life can be. And I love that scene in Inception where you know, everything starts shaking and they go, what's happening? And then they go, he's starting to notice the strangeness of the dream. And you ever notice the strangeness of life? You know, you're like, why are we doing this? I was watching this video on Instagram where this father and his daughter were talking and they're asking each other questions. And the daughter asked the dad, why do you work? And he goes, well, hang on, look at me. And she's looking down. He looks at him, you know, why do you spend all your time working? And he goes, okay, well, look at me. I do it because I, you know, I love you and I want to make money to take care of you. And well, I don't know why I work. I mean, yeah, that was like, he was like, I don't know. I don't know why I do this. I just do it. It's a really good question. You know, my question for myself recently was, wait, I've never worked in an office. I'm almost 40 years old ever since college, ever since graduating college. So I was 22, I guess. I haven't really had a real job except for about 7 or 8 months when I worked for a call center and I drove to an office every day and worked, you know, 8 to 4 or whatever it was. And then after that, I just, you know, worked from home for, you know, in a variety of contexts. And I always worked 9 to 5, especially when I had a job and I was just remote. I'd get up, brush my teeth, you know, go for a run, eat breakfast, make some coffee, sit down and start my day. And I would literally like sit at the breakfast table and work 9 to 12, stop, have a 30-minute lunch break, go back, you know, work till 5 and then be done for the day. Sometimes it was 5, 6, 7, you know, but then I'd be done for the day. And recently I was going, why do we do this anymore? Like, why do we work Monday through Friday? Why do we have office hours 9 to 5? Even those of us who, you know, work for ourselves. And I was thinking about this as an owner of a company who has employees and I employ myself. And I go, why are we doing this? Do we have to do this? You know, maybe, I don't know, you know, but I realized this was just a thing that I was doing, and I never really had the awareness or perspective to look at it and go, that's kind of weird. So life is this smattering of experiences, and you have an interpretation of it. And it is just that, right? It is just an interpretation. The story is not a fact. It's just a story, right? Your life is your life. It's not a story. It's just your life. And you need stories. You need meaning-making devices to sort of guide your way through what would otherwise be a pretty chaotic experience. Like, baby comes out of the womb, goes from one world to a completely different world, leaves the cave, leaves Plato's cave, as it were, and cries and screams. Yeah, me too. Like, what else are you going to do? That shit is scary. You are changing from one, one context to another one pretty extremely. I don't know what it's actually like for the baby, whether or not that experience is traumatic as some claim it is. But I get how it could be. And so what are you left to do but trust your experiences as they're happening and be able to hold your interpretation as a truth, but not the truth, in the sense that it was true that I experienced this thing at that time as blank, you know? But if I were to go back to the restaurant or watch the movie again, I might have a completely different experience with it. And I do think that that is the more artful way to engage with life. On one hand, you do not want to stay stuck in your story. That is not a vibrant, living kind of experience. That's a dead experience, right? If you ate a piece of chicken and that chicken made you sick, so sick that you threw up, the next time you eat a piece of chicken, you're going to have a little gag reflex, probably. You know, you're going to have a little trauma around the chicken.
It'll trigger you.
A little chicken trauma trigger. And with this chicken trauma trigger, that's an experience. You go, oh, you know, like, I'm remembering this previous experience and this is bad. But eventually you might be able to eat chicken again and enjoy it. And you might have to have a corrective experience with, like, the most amazing chicken in the world for you to be okay with chicken again. But if you had a bad experience with chicken and you never ate chicken again, and 20 years later, somebody said, would you like a piece of chicken? You would say, I don't like chicken. Well, that's not living. You're not living in life. You're living in a story, right? No, you had a bad experience with chicken once. And look, if you don't eat chicken again, that's fine, you know? But if you had a bunch of good experiences with chicken, then you had one bad experience with chicken and you're never willing to eat chicken again, well, whose problem is that? You know, is it the chicken's problem or is it your problem? Like, what's the real problem? The problem is you had a bad experience. And this is the challenge with being human, is what we call our taste, what we call the things that we like and don't like, is really an arbitrary judgment based on a pretty small set of experiences that are just that. They're just experiences. Well, I had an experience of this thing at one point, and I seem to remember enjoying that experience. So it would stand to reason that I might enjoy this next experience. So sure, I'll have some more, you know? And when we say I like it, that's shorthand for that. But real taste, it seems to me, is actually a willingness to trust your experience of each particular event as if it were happening for the first time ever, without memory, without story, without any of that stuff. And then to go, oh, I am now having this experience. Thank you for tuning into this issue of Hey Creator. I'm Jeff Goins. This show is produced by yours truly in conjunction with the very handsome Kelton Reed and the inimitable New Media Dojo. Our theme music is One Night in Las Vegas by Arthur Bassov, with additional music by Blue Dot Sessions. For extra goodies, all kinds of bonuses, you can go to heycreator.com. That's right, we have the .com domain these days. Sign up for the free newsletter. A new issue drops every single Tuesday. You get links to past episodes, other things that are happening in the Hey Creator universe, and a whole lot more. And don't forget to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. Leave a review at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you tune in. We'll see you next time. Don't forget to keep it groovy. Actually, I don't know how we start a show. Welcome to Hey Creator. I'm Jeff Goines, and this is the mixtape for the creative class where we discover together what it is we're doing with our art and with our lives. Is that it?
it's like you're looking at a script in the sky.
No, I'm trying to remember it.
Yeah. You got it. Welcome to Hey Creator. I'm Jeff Goines.
All right.
Yeah, you got it.
All right, cool. All right, let's try it again.